it's important to have an internal dialogue, a dialogue inside our minds, between asking ourselves about how we feel explicitly, what we're thinking, and then trying to get this balance so that the two aspects of our brain, the two activities, inform each other. And that should sort of keep us in check.
Have you ever wondered about how we make decisions about our money? Or why we feel the way we do about those decisions? Welcome to Nudging Financial Behavior, the podcast that aims to help you understand how and why you make certain decisions about money. Presented by Dr. Giselle Willows, an expert in behavioral finance. This podcast is all about looking at human behavior and biases, especially when it comes to your finances. You can catch the series on YouTube, the Nudging Financial Behavior blog, or on your favorite podcast platform. Be sure to like and subscribe to ensure you don't miss an episode. Special thanks to our sponsor, IG Market South Africa, a world-leading online trading provider that gives you access to opportunities across thousands of financial markets through their intuitive platforms and apps. Let's get started.
Welcome to the sixth episode of season two of the Nudging Financial Behavior podcast. I'm Dr. Giselle Willows. Can you believe we're already halfway through season two? In this series, we're breaking down human behavior and biases as we try to help you understand how and why you make certain decisions about your finances. Today, we're unpacking a bias that has a lot to do with how readily available information is, availability bias. We'll also look at survivorship bias, which is closely linked to availability, but can have a big impact on investment decisions. My guest in this episode is Hersh Shefrin, a pioneer and legend in the field of behavioral finance. Oh, and don't forget to like and subscribe to this channel so that you know when new episodes come out. It should probably go without saying that we make decisions based on the information we have at our disposal. And this is where availability bias comes in. The definition of this bias refers to how an event that has an almost non-existent probability of happening to you can be assigned a reasonable, even high probability by your mind just because the information is readily available. It's a mental shortcut that enables us to connect decisions or ideas easily based on instant or vivid examples. A great example of this was the movie Jaws. People around the world suddenly became terrified of swimming anywhere, not just in the ocean. The film was made in 1975, and people who watch it today still get scared of shark attacks thanks to that movie. And this is ridiculous, because the likelihood of being attacked by a shark while swimming in the ocean is 1 in 3.75 million, according to the International Wildlife Museum. But because the shark attack scene was so graphic in the movie, we distinctly remember it. And thus, we heighten the probability of it happening to us next time we have a day at the beach. In my own life, I saw this bias play out just last year. For my birthday, my friends got together and bought me tickets to go paragliding here in Cape Town, something I've always wanted to do. I got two tickets. It's obviously more fun jumping off a mountain with someone than by yourself. But right around that time, there was a freak accident in Cape Town and someone got killed paragliding. Yes, it was very sad, but that didn't mean I was more likely to have an accident when I went. Rationality aside, suddenly everyone who was so excited about me paragliding and people who were my potential jumping partners were no longer interested. They were suddenly really worried that something similar would happen to them. Fortunately, I do have one friend who is crazily adventurous like me, so we went paragliding together. Here's some proof. about it long enough, you'll agree that this behavior, being impacted by recent events, is ridiculous. Things don't happen more often in the real world just because they happened recently or because we can visualize them better thanks to a movie or the news. But what we hear about a topic and how that fits in with what we already think we know influences how we react to it. And that means we overestimate the perceived risk of dying while paragliding, rather than succumbing to something ordinary like the flu. It was American businessman and investor Charlie Mungo put it quite well when he compared availability bias to Frank Sinatra's song with the lyrics, "When I'm not near the girl I love the girl I'm near."
When I'm not near the girl I love the girl I'm near.
He said this in his famous speech, The Psychology of Human Misjudgment. I'll link to the full YouTube video in the show notes. I think it's safe to say that the problem with availability bias is that when making decisions, we are influenced by what's in our working memory. With this in mind, we cannot underestimate the power of someone's past lived experience on their future decisions. It's simple. What you remember from your past influences your future. But memories, stories, and examples that are more easily available to us guide us. It's also important to note that the more recent the event, the more easily it's recalled. Rolf de Belli said in The Art of Thinking Clearly,
"We create a picture of the world using the examples that most easily come to mind."
Essentially, our memory is influenced by our emotions, expectations, feelings, and what we've been exposed to. Social media coverage plays a big role here. An event that is possibly very rare, like a gas explosion in the streets of Johannesburg, might become more visible to us because there is large coverage of it online.
Now at 11, stunning new video shows the moment an apparent underground gas explosion sent shockwaves through Johannesburg, South Africa.
As the news spreads, so does the ease with which we can recall that event. But neither of these things influence the probability of the event happening again. And this is getting even more important in our lives thanks to the social media echo chamber effect. Remember Rachel Alberts from season one? She spoke to us about confirmation bias on social media.
I think the trend that we're seeing like across the world, it's not a South African problem, is that humanity is becoming very contrasted. We're seeing extreme opinions being shared, particularly on social media. And with that means that people are less interested in finding out more about things that don't necessarily appeal to them directly. I think there's a lot of danger in only valuing the opinions of people who have a similar mindset or maybe even a similar background to you. And I think that's what a lot of the danger is.
But it's not just social media. It's the news in general. There has never been so much news about the world available to us as there is right now. And it's coming from everywhere. On our TVs, our computers, our phones, even notifications on our smartwatches. Author and entrepreneur Rolf de Belli has given amazing talks on living without the news. His view is that we don't need the news, the constant barrage of headlines about stories that don't impact our lives in any way. Now, he's not saying that we shouldn't be informed about the world around us. Rather, we should explore significant events, people, and places and gain an in-depth knowledge of the parts that truly impact us.
Can you live without the news? Can you live without the day-to-day chatter about things happening? See, news is to the brain what sugar is to the body. News give you the illusion of understanding, and that illusion is dangerous. So what should you do? Read long, solid magazine articles that give you perspective. Read books that explain the world's complexities. My advice to you, go deep instead of broad in your search for knowledge. You will be more healthy, more wealthy, and more wise. Thank you.
Our constant scrolling through news headlines on social media, news apps and websites, it's not keeping us informed. It's feeding into a global anxiety and feeding into our biases, especially availability bias. Okay, stepping back into our discussion on availability bias, we also have to look out for the fact that many professionals fall victim to this bias in the workplace. Financial advisors have their favorite products, doctors have their preferred medicines, consultants have their preferred methods. Even though a more appropriate option might exist, it's not front of mind. They have their favorites and they often use and recommend them because it's what they know. While this isn't necessarily bad, it can be problematic when the situation is something outside of the norm. When you come across a new problem, you're likely to throw a familiar method at it. And that can get you into trouble because you haven't properly analyzed the problem at hand and reacted accordingly. Speaking of professionals falling prey to availability bias brings us quite nicely onto our second topic for this episode, survivorship bias. This is our tendency to look at how existing shares or companies are performing in the market and projecting that onto the entire market. The problem with that approach is that you're ignoring all the companies that failed. Triumph is more visible than failure. And because of that, we overestimate our chances of succeeding in things. As depressing as it sounds, the probability of success is actually very low. For every famous actress, there are thousands of actresses out there queuing at open calls to get a role. Trust me on that one. For every popular author, there are hundreds who can't find a publisher. And behind every successful entrepreneur, there are too many who have failed to get their business idea to fly. The problem is, we're not seeing all of the failures, only success stories. Why? Well, social media isn't interested in promoting and telling you about all the people who didn't make it. If you want to find that information, you need to go look for it yourself. In my own work, I really struggle with survivorship bias. For one, I'm very aware of confirmation bias and always try and find evidence that supports and refutes my claims. But what I find increasingly concerning is that you tend to only find the popular evidence. That's how search engine optimization works. And just because it's popular doesn't necessarily mean it's factual. And that's how availability bias spins its web and survivorship bias sneaks its way into the investigative work we might try to do. It's definitely time now to speak to my guest for this episode, Hirsch Sheffrin. Hirsch is not just a professor of finance at the Santa Clara University in California. He is also a prolific author, publishing numerous books on behavioral finance. And in 2003, the American Economic Review listed him as one of the top 15 economic theorists to have influenced empirical work. Thank you so much for joining us today, Hirsch. It's great to chat to you again.
Likewise, Giselle.
We're talking about availability bias in this episode, and I know you've done a fair bit of research on this bias, amongst others, particularly in the investing space. Can you share with us some of your findings about this bias and how it impacts our investing decisions?
I would love to do that. Let me begin with a brief example. This is how I introduce the concept in the classroom. And then after the example, I'll talk about specific issues in investing. So what I ask my students to do is to consider four hazards related to water. And I ask them, what do you think is the most hazardous in terms of annual fatalities? So here are the four: shark attacks, hurricanes, rip currents, and floods. So if you think about those four, you can sort of consider in your own experience, wherever you are in the world, which of those is the most dangerous. So in the US, the answer turns out to be rip currents. And that is typically a huge surprise to most of my students or most of the audiences to whom I pose this question. Because after all, hurricanes and floods, most people do know, except after the film Jaws came out, that shark attacks are not something that is particularly dangerous, except in the few events where it happens. Perhaps in South Africa, it's a bit more frequent than in the U.S. But, you know, rip currents, you know, are simply people walking out into the ocean and being dragged out and drowning. And there are more rip current deaths per year than deaths from any of the other three. And the question is why? And it's largely because the media reports on dramatic events like shark attacks and floods and hurricanes. But rip currents simply are individual events that very rarely make the headlines. And so information about rip currents is not readily available the way information about shark attacks, hurricanes, and floods is readily available. And that's why we have a bias called availability bias. Availability bias means putting too much weight on data sources that are readily available, especially if the source of the data is memory. All right, so that sort of gives you the intuition as to what the bias means. Now, what about real-world examples? So here is a real-world water hazard example that's a bit different than the other four. It relates to Fukushima Daiichi, the nuclear reactor that experienced a meltdown in Japan about a decade ago. And why did it experience a meltdown? It experienced a meltdown because of a combination of an earthquake followed by a tsunami that struck the reactor itself. Why would availability bias figure in to this particular event? Well, it figures in because of the way the Japanese built Fukushima Daiichi. They built it to withstand a major earthquake, but not a major tsunami. And why would they do that? It's because the Japanese experience a lot of earthquakes, but far fewer tsunamis. Even though tsunami is a Japanese word, tsunamis are just not part of the Japanese consciousness, at least they hadn't before Fukushima Daiichi, than earthquakes are. So availability bias was a strong driver of the design of Fukushima Daiichi that led them to be vulnerable to the impact of a major tsunami. I will tell you, and it really is, it is fact, when you try to assess the risks, you plan for a 1 in 10,000 year event. That's what they should have done with tsunami data. Thought about what happens over a 10,000 year period in respect to the histogram of major tsunamis. But they didn't do that. They chose just one data point, a recent tsunami off the coast of South America that was relatively minor compared to what they actually experienced. So that event, because it was relatively recent when they were doing the design, it was a readily available event, and so they succumbed to availability bias. So that is investment. It's corporate investment as opposed to what individual investors do, but it's an example from investment. I'll give you an investing example, though, the firm BP. So I hope many of you will recall the catastrophic events around the explosion of Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico. I will tell you that 2 years before that explosion, I wrote that I thought that most investors had the wrong perspective on BP stock and BP as a company, that most investors thought that BP was an environmentally friendly company because it invested in alternative energy. And it was very good at PR. But if you actually looked at what BP did, if you looked below the surface, if you looked below the level at which data was readily available, you'd see that it was an environmentally hostile company. It was winning all kinds of awards for being socially responsible before Deepwater Horizon. But the real story was different. So I even mentioned in my writings that there was a threat to operations in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, but in the end, availability bias prevailed, both within the company and BP, but also in the investment community in terms of investors who invested in BP.
Yes, such a powerful bias and some really impactful examples that you shared there. I mean, something that's closely linked to availability bias is also survivorship bias, which adds a whole other dimension to things. We know that triumph is more visible than failure. But as a researcher, in all your writings, your years of research, you'll know how imperative it is to ensure our samples aren't a victim of this. Can you share any experiences about that particular bias?
Sure. Think about Apple as a company, you know, the most valuable company in the world. It invented the iPhone, and it has certainly survived and thrived. But living in Silicon Valley, and having lived in Silicon Valley through the 1990s, through the dot-com bubble, and the period thereafter, you also see other companies that were working on developing smartphones besides Apple. Palm, for example, was a company that was really famous around 2000, and yet it didn't survive. So we think about Apple in terms of a success, but we encounter availability bias when it comes to the firms that didn't survive. And so then you get availability bias driving survivorship bias. There's only one winner. We remember the winners. This is an issue from a research perspective when you're trying to think about how to fundamentally value a company. So, for example, in my research, I've looked at a set of six technology stocks, Microsoft, and then an acronym called FANG, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, now called Alphabet. And when you look at these companies, they are major companies, but in the way that their value is assessed by financial analysts tend to be excessively optimistic about the valuations they place on these companies. And it happens because they commit a bias called growth opportunities bias that stems from availability bias. And growth opportunity bias is the assumption that a successful company can earn more than its cost of capital indefinitely. It will always be a winner into the long term, it's not just a short-term phenomenon. And we teach in textbooks, we teach our students to be really careful to assume that in the long term, you shouldn't expect companies to earn more than their cost of capital unless there's a good reason to do that, like patent protection or government protection. So you wind up having to be careful about this. It's important that financial analysts be careful about this. And honestly, for the most part, they're not. So this is kind of an issue that comes up that links the two issues you asked about, Giselle, availability bias and survivorship bias.
Yes, makes sense. I just want to break for a second and tell my listeners a quick story about when I first met you. You probably won't remember these details, but when I first met you back in 2014 during my time at Berkeley, we had arranged to meet at a coffee shop near your university campus. I had to take a train to get there, and as I was sitting on the train, I suddenly thought, oh no, I didn't bring his book along to sign. How rude. Because then you were already a really prolific writer. And at the time, you had a very well-known book out called Beyond Greed and Fear. I remember thinking that maybe, I mean, I am going into a university coffee shop. Maybe there'd be a bookshop near the train station. So as I'm walking to the coffee shop, maybe I could quickly buy the book, but no luck. And then obviously, being the direct person that I am, I think it was the first thing I said as I met you. I was like, hello, I'm so sorry, I don't have your book with me. But you just brushed it off and got chatting and it was like nothing had happened. Anyway, where am I going with the story? Fast forward a few months later, I'm back in South Africa at UCT, sitting in my office, and I get a call from reception saying that I have a delivery. Guess what? It's your book. It's your book. And I've actually got it over here with me. And more than that, here's the book. You'd actually written a message in it for me. So I'm not sure if the camera can pick this up. They can actually see this inscription there that you wrote.
It reads, to Giselle, whose energy will take behavioral finance to the next level, with very best wishes, Hirsch.
It was such a touching gesture, and I really appreciated it. And why I'm mentioning it is because I want to touch on fear and greed, because we know these two emotions are at the root of our biases. What do you think, or what can you tell us about fear and greed, and what can you tell us about how we can manage those emotions in our trading and investing decisions?
That is, thank you for that question. I started out in the behavioral area, focusing on the fact that when people make decisions, they do it by combining mental inputs based on both how they feel and what they think. And how they feel is critical. So balance is important, because most of us really need to have these two elements in our minds, both helping us to assess situations and figure out what makes sense in terms of decisions. Too much fear, or too much, I prefer the word hope to greed, although there's this phrase, greed and fear, or fear and greed, that people use to describe emotions in investing. I should say that greed is really, it's one of the deadly fatal sins. You know, hope isn't a sin. But it's really hope people have in mind when they use the term greed. Hope is being a feeling of optimism about favorable outcomes occurring, and it's the need to feel successful as well when you set yourself goals. So if we have excessive fear or excessive hope that take us out of balance relative to being grounded in reality, then we might wind up erring in terms of the investment decisions we make, particularly if we're retail investors, individual investors. If too much fear, then we might proceed with too much caution. We know the expression fight, flight, or freeze. Fear tends to make us freeze when we need to take action, and it might lead us to engage in excessive flight when that could be to our detriment. And on the other hand, excessive hope can lead us to engage in excessive risk-taking, where we are imprudent in the way that we take risks, too much, going after too much upside, and then suffering the consequences because the downside is what actually occurs. So the lesson that I offer in Beyond Greed and Fear is it's important to have an internal dialogue, a dialogue inside our minds, between asking ourselves about how we feel explicitly, what we're thinking, and then trying to get this balance so that the two aspects of our brain, the two activities, inform each other. And that should sort of keep us in check. At the very end of Beyond Greed and Fear, I just provide a short set of suggestions for retail investors. And the suggestions go something like this. The difference between behavioral finance and standard traditional finance is that those of us in behavioral finance believe that markets are not always efficient, that there are opportunities for positive alpha, that you can, in theory, sometimes beat the market because of mispricing. But if you choose to try to earn positive alpha, please remember you expose yourself to an additional source of risk besides financial risk. You expose yourself to sentiment risk. The risk of other investors making mistakes that cause your best laid investment plans to go awry. So you take on excessive risk when you go for alpha. And in addition, your own biases might be too powerful and they negate your opportunity to actually capture the alpha that's there. So it's really complicated, much more nuanced and subtle than our intuition tends to suggest to us. And these are things to keep in mind when we are setting out to put in place an investment strategy.
Very wise words. And then for those of us who are managing clients, because I've got quite a number of financial planners that listen to this podcast, it's one thing to tell the individual investor to have that internal dialogue, but how do we help the financial planner relay that down to their clients and help them manage that fear and greed or hope?
I think that financial advisors need to understand that their roles are not just about advising on portfolios or constructing portfolios or doing small questionnaires to elicit risk tolerance. But they really need to have a behavioral skill set that goes along with a financial skill set. And that behavioral skill set includes the ability to structure conversations with clients about the internal dialogue. So they need to get comfortable asking their clients how they feel. They need to get comfortable asking their clients about their emotions. In a sense, they need to have a psychological toolkit that's similar in nature to what therapists have. Now, we don't want our financial analysts to become therapists or to get super deep into issues that really only professionally trained therapists should engage in, but they need to wade into that territory in order to elicit feelings and elicit views on what their clients are thinking, and then help them by example. And that often means by using themselves as examples, explain to their clients how they think about managing the internal dialogue, the internal conversation about feelings and thoughts. And of course, supplying their clients with perspectives and facts in terms of what to think about. So it's about balancing the discussion with clients in the same way that the internal conversation takes place.
Yes, we do ask a lot of our financial planners, but this is really an important thing for them to be aware of in their profession and what they do. Thank you so much, Hirsch. It's been a real privilege to have you on the podcast as my guest. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a delight, Giselle. Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's so interesting that we use the terms fear and greed. They're both so negative. I like what Hirsch was saying about using the term hope rather than greed. It gives a different spin on that internal dialogue and hopefully will help you and me to keep balancing things. Okay, let's bring it back to availability bias and wrap things up here. Don't overestimate information that is available to you. Just because you know someone who did no exercise and lived to a healthy 100 years of age doesn't mean that you shouldn't exercise. Rather, ask yourself how you can use the science of availability to make your life better. Is it better to live your life and believe the world is not as bad as commonly portrayed, or watch the news every day where you'll be shown constant death and destruction because that's what sells? Lastly, when coming across a new problem, check yourself before throwing a familiar method at it. Is it perhaps a more appropriate approach that you haven't tried before? If you haven't figured it out already, perhaps the best way to use this bias in your favor is to become a storyteller. The more exciting and vivid your story, the easier it'll be to convince someone of something. Trial lawyers are masterful storytellers. They figured out that it's not the facts that move people, it's the stories that do. Availability bias is absolutely one of the most important biases that you really need to be aware of. It's so easy to fall prey to it and can be quite a tricky one to spot. I suppose it's probably wrong that I'm hoping that availability bias will play out for you right now and encourage you to like this episode. We've reached the end. I hope you enjoyed it.
That was Nudging Financial Behavior, hosted by behavioral finance expert, Dr. Giselle Willows. Make sure you like and subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. You can catch the Nudging Financial Behavior podcast on YouTube, our blog, or your favorite podcast streaming platform. Thank you again to our sponsors, IG Markets South Africa, for helping to bring the show to life. And now for the disclaimer. This podcast should not be seen as advice. All the information and opinions are of a general nature. They are not intended to address the needs or circumstances of any individual. We are not financial advisors, neither are any of our staff or service providers, nor is our sponsor. All expressions of opinion by the host or guest are subject to change without notice in reaction to shifting market conditions. Any information you get from us should be seen as only that, information only.